Redeemer, by Guy Haley. There were chords of pain that played for Astaroth alone to hear. Music that troubled the dreams of insane composers haunted his waking hours. If it played anywhere, anywhere at all, then he would hear it. Most often, he heard a lonely tune wrung from one miserable instrument, but at times these soloists would be joined by others to make quartets or sections, and in the worst of days, an entire melancholic orchestra would gather. Then, the music would sing most urgently to him across time and space. Always it was discordant, tragic, full of pain and anger, notes played out of sequence as less talented hands fumbled their way over a maestro's work. The music recalled something great nonetheless, and was all the more painful for imperfection. These outpourings were for others to tame. The duty of his brother chaplains was to get the strings to play in tune, to conduct the suffering towards a last crescendo. When the brothers in black and bone took the lead, the music would climax and cease, and in the ceasing, Astaroth the Grim would know all had returned to rightness. Sometimes the music did not stop. Sometimes it rose to unbearable heights, past all hope of redemption, down to the blackest pits of despair, where it continued, polluting all around with its pain. It was Astaroth's role, as Blood Angel's High Chaplain, to end these painful discords. His solemn duty was fratricide. His axe tasted noble Space Marine blood, as often as it did the vitae of the Imperium's enemies. The Ender of Songs, the Eldari called him, and apt though that was, he had a better known title. To the chapters of the blood, he was the Redeemer of the Lost, and he was loved and loathed in equal measure for his excellence and his duty. Astaroth slept his way across the light years. Wherever he went, his sarcophagus travelled with him, seated in the place of honour at the heart of the eminent Sanguis. Only a few of the most high blood angels had their own personal sarcophagus. Astaroth was naturally among them. The exterior of his sarcophagus was decorated with stylized sculpture that depicted the warrior inside. Although distorted by being wrapped around the lid, it was unmistakably Astaroth, rendered in the abyssal black of the polished carbon. The sarcophagus was set at an angle of 45 degrees at the centre of a ring of carvings depicting the High Chaplain's responsibilities. In Astaroth's chamber, all was chill. Frost coated the carvings. Red lumens bathed the room in a bloody glow. The black shadows hid from it. The colours echoed Astaroth's inner world. While Astaroth slept, his dreams were of black, and they were of red, and nothing else, until somewhere a warrior's soul broke, and the music began again. Each song was different. He heard this one as a screeching passage that rose and stopped and began again, over and over, a piece badly practiced, whose end could not be attained. It penetrated the bloody red. It sent ripples over the oily black. The music called to him, for it could call to no one else. The song was a plea for mercy only he could grant. It woke him. Stirred from his slumber, Astaroth opened his eyes and the blood-threaded amnion nourishing his body. The sarcophagus's machine spirit detected the movement and began the process of full awakening. Drains opened at the base of the sarcophagus to suck the amnion away. The mask covering Astaroth's mouth came free. The amnion level dropped past his chin, and he took his first free breath since he had lain down to rest. The needle interfaces of monitoring machines slid from the sockets of his black carapace. Thick tubes, twisted like umbilical cords, suckled greedily at the arteries in his forearms, thighs, and neck as he slept. They throbbed now as they returned his purified blood to him and detached from his skin with sorrowful kisses, Light falling on the black sculpture changed, fading from sanguine to gentle red gold, the colour of the sunlight of Belor. Inset wheels spun within the sarcophagus's ornate decoration, locks disengaged, a heavy bar disguised as the figure's crossed arms lifted and rose, and the lid slid up and away. Astaroth sat up, pale skin and jet-black hair glistened with residual preservative fluid. "Sergeant Dolomon," he said. His voice was quiet yet filled with authority. Vox thieves, hidden in the room's decoration, opened up communications with the command deck.
"My lord."
"A brother is lost. Prepare our navigator for fresh directions. We have work to do." The eminent Sanguis appeared on no roll of service for the Blood Angels. It was not expected to take part in the chapter's battles, and rarely did. It had been requested, built and commissioned solely as the personal transport of the High Chaplain, and had conveyed many holders of the office across the galaxy. Sepulchral halls linked somber chambers. Every being upon that craft, whether unmodified human, tech priest, or angel of death, understood the solemnity of their mission and carried themselves with utmost dignity. The Eminent Sanguis was a near-silent ship, where robed figures went on solitary errands. Its machine spirit was as cold as the void outside its plasteel skin, and as distant as the stars it sailed for. It was a fast ship, quick in the void, but swiftest in the warp. Although it was of low mass, in the realm of the warp, concepts had more importance than physical truths, and the ship was heavy with duty. So singular was its purpose, it cut easily through the conflicting currents of ideas that made the Immaterium treacherous. Not even the madness of chaos could deny the weight of Astaroth's work. Aided by the importance of its mission and the faith of those aboard, it passed through the worst of storms and made impressive speed whatever etheric tempest curdled the Sea of Souls. In the nightmare of the warp, the Eminent Sanguis turned aside from its prior destination towards the source of the song. Astaroth's armour terrified the mortals who came to greet him. There were only three of them, stood at the edge of the landing platform when he emerged from the dank forest. And they were frightened, for death stood behind him. His battle-plate ceramite was carved to resemble musculature exposed by flaying, and was painted to match. His jump pack was an arcane design, its form dictated more by art than function. And to the cowering men and single woman, he appeared to be blessed with wings. The pinions were immobile, sculptures of metal as crow-black as his hair, yet to them they seemed real. His pauldron was a field of skulls. His knee pads featured more of the same. The axe he carried was as tall and heavy as the largest of the mortals, with a haft fashioned to resemble a spine. All he carried and all he wore spoke of the ending of life. The world of Askew only accentuated his deathly aspect. The Blood Angel's Storm Raven squatted on a rusted landing platform, half overtaken by forest growth. Support pillars were engulfed by rippled grey wood. Slimy creepers strangled guardrails and buried machinery in wet mats of giving flesh. The ship was black, covered in red saltares and glaring skulls. Upon the ancient pad it resembled the ornamentation on an overgrown tomb, peeking out through a cemetery's ruin. Mould crawled up every surface of the arcing roots, holding the fungus trees off the ground. Clouds of their spores floated past in granular mists. The free mortals wore heavy respirators to protect themselves against the spores, but Astaroth had no need of such protection and stood before them bareheaded, a winged giant clad in skinned muscle. In the gloom of the fungal forest, his pale skin appeared blue. He was flanked by Sergeant Dolomon and the sanguinary priest Artemis, his only companions from the chapter. Together they represented the triumvirate of bone, blood, and death that shaped the Blood Angel's soul. They were doom incarnate. Astaroth did not look human, and he was not. The mortals were right to be afraid.
"Where are our brothers?"
Astaroth asked them through bloodless lips. Despite their protection, the mortal's eyes were rimmed red with spore exposure. The leader, the female, spoke with her voice, roughened by poor quality air. She was old, but had that wiry strength certain women keep until the end of their lives.
"They are this way, my lord," she said, pointing a wavering arm behind her to tangles of roots and trunks receding into the spore-blue air.
Astroff looked into the forest. Far off, the music played.
"Take me there," he said. "Dolomon, guard the ship."
The men and women looked at each other nervously. None of them wished to be the one to start the march. The idea of telling Astroff what to do, even when asked to provide guidance, seemed to fill them with terror.
"Take me now," Astroff said.
Relieved to be commanded, the civilians led the way down a run of rock-crete stairs that was so buried in rotted matter, fungal stands and roots, it appeared no more than an animal track.
"You, female, tell me what happened here."
Astaroth's footsteps were heavy, thumping on the soft ground like dying heartbeats.
"Your brother took the Ordi's meat," began the woman.
"From the beginning, tell me of this place. Tell me what happened to you before my brothers came. It will help me understand what has befallen them."
So she did. Her name, she said, was Sranna. Astaroth filed it away with a million other names, never to be forgotten.
"This world is not a bad world," Sranna began. "I have read of others. I know there are worse places than Askew."
They were obliged to duck through interlaced rubbery vines whose rough surfaces adhered to them. Astaroth and Artemis shoved their way through with difficulty, for the vines would not break, and the path the humans took were too small for them. As Astaroth forced his way out, the woman glanced back to see if she had spoken out of place. Astaroth's return stare had her turning her face away twice as quickly.
"Before the Silent Ones came, we lived in sunlight up there."
She pointed upwards, where arrow-straight trunks lifted off from their cradles of roots, though she did not look too afraid or too saddened by what had happened.
"Up there are our homes. This is our world, not this place. Up there is no mold. The air is clean. The weather is warm. We had good lives."
"The nature of this world's purpose?"
"The production and export of chemical products derived from the great fungi," she said. "Their wood is no good. It is black-hearted, rots quickly. No use for building. But when bled and boiled, it gives useful liqueurs. We had our duties to the Imperium, and we fulfilled them."
She dared to look back again.
"All we wish is to do so again, to live in the sun and pay our dues to the God Emperor. We worked hard, we prayed hard. I am so sorry about what has happened here. Please, let the Emperor know we are sorry for whatever we did to anger him and bring this disaster on ourselves. I am so sorry the Red Angels came to help us, and this happened. I..."
"What happened here is not your fault," said Astaroth bluntly. "You have done no wrong. If you had, I would kill you. But you need not fear punishment from me, unless there is some element of your tale that is deserving of harsher judgment."
She shook her head.
"None. No, my lord. We did nothing. We are victims, I think. Maybe the meat. Maybe we poisoned him."
"All humanity is a victim in these dark times. If you speak the truth, you have nothing to fear. You did not poison him. Continue your tale."
"The rift came. The sky turned sick. The Silent Ones came soon afterwards. They appeared in nightmares at first. Pale, naked things the size of half-grown children. Pot-bellied, long arms. Horrible in proportion. But their faces were the worst. They were blank. No eyes or nose. Only a curved mouth full of jutting teeth. We all dreamt about them, standing in the corner of our sleeping chambers, staring at us."
She shuddered at the memory.
"It didn't take long for us to realize that we dreamed of the same things, of silent, pale faces with no eyes. A few panicked children was all it took. Word got around, we were afraid. We worked on as best we could. Then the Tithe ships stopped coming. Then the merchantmen. We produce enough food for ourselves, but are dependent on outsiders for many other things. We sent out messages from our astropaths in the capital, but got no reply. They tried harder, until one by one they went mad, and so Count Mania ordered no more attempts be made in order to save the last.
When was this?
Decades ago. I was young then, old enough to remember how things were. There are no sky speakers now. Some of what I relate to you was told to me by my mother.
You speak of matters dealt with by the planetary government.
My mother was advisor to the Count. I am of noble birth, she cackled, though you would not believe it now.
Continue.
The dreams became worse. Then they stopped being dreams. We woke in the night to find the Silent Ones looking at us. They'd vanish after a while, but they were there. We had pics and vid captures.
She went quiet.
Then, after a little longer, they started to hunt us.
They passed along a road broken to useless slabs by fungal roots.
We killed a few. They were flesh and blood, it seemed, and it gave us heart. But they came and went as they wished. We struggled to trap them. We couldn't see them. They picked us off at their leisure. We were afraid to sleep. So many of us died in nights of terror, and we were driven from our homes down here. They didn't come down here so much, on account of the spores, maybe. We managed to hold on, but we were dying slowly. The Count took the chance with our last astropath and sent the message. I was a girl still then. It took so long to answer. We didn't think anyone would come. Then your brothers arrived, and they were cunning and brave and killed many of the Silent Ones. Everything looked like it would be good again. It was, for a while. They took back this township for us, so we could look on the sun. They drove the creatures deeper into the forest. We began to rebuild.
They reached a stairway choked by outgrowths of the tree it circled, and started to climb upwards.
Then your brother took the Ordei's meat, and suddenly it wasn't good anymore. She smiled weakly. Come on, it's this way.
When Astaroth and Artemis arrived in the reclaimed township, they found their brothers out on patrol, and so settled down to wait for their return in a room in a derelict habitat.
We should consider the possibility that this entire planet must be purged, said Artemis, speaking in a private helm-to-helm vox. You heard what she said? The old rules are not so rigidly applied, said Astaroth. Word of demons has spread now. Once, even you would not have known of them, brother. How can knowledge of them be hidden when they walk openly across the galaxy?
Knowledge isn't what bothers me, said Artemis.
He lifted a ragged curtain and glanced out through a cracked window. The habitat overlooked a landscape of lacy branches that moved in the light of the planet's moon.
This whole place might be tainted. You know what it's like when they get their fingers in the minds of men.
If every world that had known the touch of the demon since the rift opened was laid waste, there would be no Imperium left, said Astaroth. Purity of thought is the best safeguard. The question of whether this world is tainted is for others to answer. It is not obviously so, and we do not have the resources to deal with it if it is. Our mission is to secure our missing brother.
Artemis shrugged.
You are right. I speak prematurely. The things here could have been Chaos War predators rather than demons. Or they could be a strange kind of Xenos, some of those things the Eldari consort with.
He shook his head and let the curtain drop.
Xenos or a demon, they are filth, all of them. The galaxy is not what it was. The old evils come sneaking out of the shadows.
Put these questions from your mind, brother priest, said Astaroth. Whatever they are not our business. Mercy for the lost is our sole concern.
They waited a few hours for the Blood Angels assigned to Askew to return to the outpost. A single half-squad had been sent, and there were three of them left, all Primaris Marines. They were not surprised to find Astaroth at the township.
I am Brother Fedlus, 11th Squad, 3rd Battle Company, Acting Sergeant,
said the warrior who'd led them. "These are Edmund and Caspian. Are you High Chaplain?"
"I am," Astaroth confirmed.
"Then I greet you as my lord." Phidlas dropped to his knee and bowed his head.
"May the blessings of the angels' virtues and graces fill you and carry you through battle, my brother. Now rise."
Phidlas stood up.
"Who is the one who is afflicted?" Astaroth asked.
"Brother Sergeant Erymas." Astaroth paused before asking his next question.
"And is Brother Sergeant Erymas like you or like me?"
The gravity of his question seemed to distort space around them. "He is not a Primaris brother, my lord, if that is what you mean," said Phidlas.
"So you were deployed as a mixed squad?"
"At our captain's command," said Phidlas. He looked at his brothers. "We three are among those raised from the Great Blooding. We lack experience. Erymas came to teach us."
"You fought as mortals on the walls of Arx Angelicum?"
"We did," said Phidlas.
"There were four of us, Primaris Marines, until the Xenos things slew Brother Aelos.
The four of us and Erasmus were deemed enough for the task at hand, but these things are slippery and claim their due in blood." Erymas said. He shared a look with his brothers. Astaroth recognized it, for he had seen it many times, the look of a blood angel exposed for the first time to the effects of the rage.
"Erymas said Aelos made a grave error, and that we must learn from it. He said Aelos's death was a fair exchange for the thousands of their dead, and we will avenge him.
We were looking for the Silent Ones when you arrived. They stay away from the population now. We've cleansed most of this sector. We'll get the rest."
"Are they demons?" asked Artemis.
"I know little of demons, but I don't believe so," said Phidlas. "They are easy enough to kill, though they are stealthy. They're psychically able, they cloud the mind. They're never where you think they are, but they are flesh and blood. There's not very many of them. Dangerous to unmodified humans, but little threat to us. I can imagine how easy it was for them to wreak havoc on a planet this sparsely populated. But we would have had this continent secure and been on our way to the other hemisphere if it weren't for..." He paused again. Disquiet showed in his eyes.
"If it weren't for this..." "What became of Aelos's gene seed?" asked Artemis.
"It was lost. We tried to save it, but we could not. We have no priest with us. I apologize. Perhaps it could have been retrieved, but I do not have the skills." Phidlas turned his attention to Astaroth. "If you have responded to our message, then the worst has happened. I didn't believe it was possible. Erymas was so noble."
"You thought it something else?"
"I am no expert, and hope deceived me, perhaps. But I hope so. If you are here, it is not some other thing. It is the Black Rage."
"It is," Astaroth confirmed.
"I am surprised you arrived so swiftly. I sent word only days ago."
"I did not get your summons," said Astaroth. "I require no message. The music of torment called me, so I came."
"It happened here," said Brother Caspian. "They were in a house built around the topmost trunk of arrow-like trees. The spongy wood, slender as a man at that point, made a central pillar around which all else was constructed. Broken pots lay about, and a smear of blood darkened the wall. Brother Sergeant Erymas had been behaving erratically all day, but we did not know what we were seeing. If we had, we would have acted."
"Be calm, young brother. This is not your doing," said Astaroth.
Caspian nodded gratefully.
"They were giving us a feast in our honour when Erasmus turned. He ate the meat, and then something happened. And before we could react, he had killed two of the mortals, shouting as he did about traitors and being trapped. We tried to restrain him, but his strength was too great and he escaped. The natives have not returned here since it happened."
"Relations seem good otherwise," said Astaroth.
"Phidlas convinced them Erasmus was influenced by the creatures. They were shocked a space marine could be so effective, but they believed it," said Edmund.
"I do not like to trade in falsehood," said Phidlas. "Forgive me." "A lesser evil. Let them continue to believe it so," said Astaroth. "It would be for the best if that remains the story they tell after we are gone."
"Better they fear the alien than their protectors, brothers," said Artemis.
"Better still that the twin curses of our gene line remain secret,"
said Astaroth.
They feared their meat offended us, and triggered this behaviour somehow, said Edmund. Is that how it happens?
He asked, tentatively. Astaroth watched the Primaris Marines closely. Though the new Space Marines bred seemed resistant to the floor, they were still taught the rituals and the severity of the curse. To little effect, it seemed. So many had been inducted so quickly that they had had no time to learn properly.
The woman, Shrana, she mentioned this Ordes meat. Was there anything unusual about it?
They said it was a delicacy. They were excited. The animal has to be hunted, and they have not been able to hunt since the creatures came. It was bloody and tough, but of good savour, said Phidlas. Could it have been the cause?
It is most unlikely, said Astaroth.
He paced around the room and stopped by the bloodstain.
Whose blood is this?
Brother Erasmus's,
said Caspian, ashamed.
I injured him.
Astaroth pulled a strip of spongy fungus wood from the wall. He chewed on it, letting snatches of experience he teased from the coagulated blood. There was little genetic material, and therefore little could be gleaned beneath the ponderous thoughts of trees. Astaroth got impressions of bewilderment and fear, then the anguished tune of Erasmus's soul played loud and drowned out all else. And he spat the chewed wood out.
The rage comes unannounced. You all partook of the meat.
Phidlas nodded.
Then it was not the cause. You are unaffected. No increase in your thirst.
None, my lord. It does not affect us the same way, said Phidlas, almost apologetically. Astaroth looked around the room,
and Erasmus burst out of that door after you wounded him.
Yes, my lord. Erasmus then dropped to the forest floor, said Phidlas.
130 feet, Edmund said, disbelievingly.
He had his battle plate, said Phidlas. No weapon except his combat knife. He vanished. We've combed the area thoroughly, grid by grid. Edmund is a good tracker.
I lost him. We followed his trail to the bounds of the next settlement, where the trail gave out. The enemy tried a sortie against us there, and we were forced to fight. When it was done, I could not find his tracks again.
Astaroth nodded, still examining the room.
I'm finished here. Tell the people of this village they have nothing to fear. Soon you will be able to complete your mission, for the greater glory of the Emperor. First, you must direct me to where the greatest concentration of enemy are.
But why? Said Phidlas. They are to the north, Brother Sergeant Erasmus ran south.
He will be where the enemy are, said Astaroth. We are warriors. We suffer a warrior's curse. Though they may be violent towards their own, those under the influence of the Black Rage are still servants of the Emperor. They fight for him until the end, however misguidedly.
Astaroth prepared for the giving of mercy. He had stripped the top portion of his armour off and sat cross-legged in a habitat yet to be reclaimed by the planet's depleted people. Artemis held out his bare arm for Astaroth to cut, and with the sanguinary priest's blood, Astaroth anointed his skin. He lapped at Artemis's wrist twice to blunt his red thirst, and, through the vitae of Sanguinius running through Artemis's veins to remember the sacrifice of their Primarch, the curse music sang in Astaroth's mind as the blood filled his mouth.
You can't go alone, Artemis said.
He wiped his arm and clad it in ceramite again. The ritual was a businesslike affair. Under such circumstances, the armouring of the soul was done with the same practical battlefield efficiency as the reloading of a bolt gun.
The settlement to the north is full of the enemy. We should all go.
I have fought some of the most celebrated heroes of the blood, brother. These creatures are feeble. They will not slow me. And when I find Erasmus, I will best him.
The blood symbols were dying on Astaroth's skin. He sheathed his blade and began to collect his armor pieces.
Let me come with you.
This is my duty alone, brother.
Artemis helped him don his backplate and breastplate, holding them in place while Astaroth bolted them together with a sanctified power driver.
Then take some of Erasmus's Primaris brothers with you, as a precaution against mishap. We cannot afford to lose you, when we have lost so much already.
Astaroth looked over his shoulder at Artemis's eyes.
Are you suggesting a mere sergeant might get the better of me?
No, my lord.
He returned to his armour.
There will be no mishap. The Primaris Marines will remain here. It is inevitable that they will see the effects of the Black Rage firsthand one day, for we all do, whether as witnesses or sufferers. I would prefer them not to yet. The Primaris Brethren brought hope to our chapter. It is best if as few of them as possible see the curse that afflicts the rest of us. The chapters of the Blood have been through much these last centuries. Allow us a moment of resurgence before we face the monsters within again. The truth will out. Truth always does. However, it will be many years before these Primaris Marines return to Baal. They have done good work here, but this entire world must be freed. They may die before they can pass the information on to others of their kind. Are you sure I cannot accompany you? Astaroth ran his thumb lightly down the edge of the executioner's axe, blood beaded on his skin. I go alone, Artemus. He pushed his still bleeding hand into his gauntlet and locked it into place. Do not ask again. The forests of Askew were silent. So dominant were the fungi forms and moulds that animal life was scarce. Astaroth walked roads high over the ground, choked by fungal growth. Symbiotic relationships with the fungi were common in the few animal species which thrived, and ever-adaptable humanity had taken their lead. The road was carried on buttresses, encouraged to grow from nearby fungus trees, but the network required maintenance. In the years since the rift, the sky roads had buckled, and the marks of human habitation everywhere were vanishing. It took so little to erase humanity's efforts from existence. Astaroth's duties, though obscure, were ultimately a part of the fight against that. To prevent mankind vanishing from history, like so many hundreds of species before. The town rose in delicate towers, high above the canopy. Once he had passed under the shadow of the first, he encountered the enemy. A pallid, bloated shape disentangled itself from the shadows and leapt at him. Astaroth's head buzzed with psychic interference. He could not see it clearly at first, but the efforts undertaken to improve a Space Marine's mind were as great as those that went into rebuilding his body. He shook the thing's influence off, and its form was revealed to him. It was vaguely humanoid, mushroom pale, bloated, disgusting as so many Xenos were. Hooked claws in its wrists squealed off his armour. The mouth snapped at him, every bit as hideous as Sranna had said. "Surprise is your chief weapon, creature," said Astaroth.
He grabbed it by the throat and held it aloft. It was surprisingly strong and would easily slay a mortal man.
"But you have little else, and nothing that can do harm to me."
In his grip, the beast was helpless. It thrashed around and hissed until its breath was spent and it was dead. He dropped the pasty thing. It sank bonelessly into itself and began to emit clouds of yellow spores from its body. Astaroth strode on, following strains of a funeral tune only he could hear.
"Brother Erasmus!" he shouted.
His amplified vox echoed down silent streets, scaring up rare aviforms and startling parasitic growths into shedding slimy seeds.
"Brother Erasmus! Return to us! Return to your chapter! Return for the Emperor's mercy!"
His shouting attracted the creatures. En masse, they clouded his mind more effectively, but he aimed his blows at the blurred shapes and cleaved them down anyway. They sought to bury him under a weight of their bodies, and did, but they could not penetrate his armour. Soft fangs pried at his seals, sharp claws scraped at his ceramite. The Emperor's armament held firm against their efforts, and they died by the dozen.
"You do not learn," he said, striking them down. "You cannot harm me."
He paced his blows to preserve his strength, weathering the soft drumming of their alien fists on his battle plate, and chopping them down with a forester's steady rhythm. Killing all the way, he passed into the inner districts of the town, where grand squares were upheaved by the unchecked movements of living supports. Towers were choked by the rubbery vines, great tangles of them bursting from every window. The further he went, the more creatures appeared, all attacking without consideration for their feebleness. His boots crunched on human bones made soft by decay. Thousands had died here, and it sorrowed him. Finally, A rune flickered into being upon his helmet plate. A chime announced his true quarry was near. He activated his jump pack and burst from a knot of the creatures. Black wings spread, prolonging his short flight. He directed himself to a broad platform overlooking a further square, and there he found Brother Erasmus. The fallen sergeant raged and screamed, shouting imprecations at enemies 10,000 years dead. The blood red of his armor was obscured by milky alien blood and brilliant smears of yellow spores. His knife had broken halfway along the blade, but he wielded it as if it were the finest sword. 100 of the fungoid creatures swarmed him. Astaroth wondered how long Erasmus had fought. It was not unusual for a brother gripped by the rage to fight until his heart burst, the ferocity of the affliction being enough to overtax a space marine's body. But if Brother Sergeant Erasmus had fought since the day he had fallen, he showed no signs of fatigue, and still killed with great efficiency. Astaroth watched a while. Though the black rage was a terrible curse, those afflicted displayed an echo of the Primarch's martial glory when they fought, and the sight never failed to move him. The music of Erasmus's suffering sang loudly in his mind.
"Terrible and glorious," Astaroth said, then called out, "Brother, I am coming to you. Stand fast. Soon your suffering shall be done."
He ignited his jets and thundered down into combat. They fought side by side, purging the town of its infestation. Astaroth's axe buzzed through the Xenos, trailing lightning, and in short time, the battle was done. The High Chaplain faced the lost brother.
"Father," Erasmus cried, his voice choked with spiritual pain, "have you come? Is Horus dead?"
"He is long dead," Astaroth said calmly. He held his axe across his body in both hands. "Come to me, and know an end to suffering."
"If he is dead, why do I see him standing over me? Why does my blood leave my body? Oh, father, why have you forsaken me?"
The lost brother threw himself at Astaroth, and the day's real fighting began. Erasmus was possessed by the death memories of Sanguinius, and full of desperate strength. Astaroth judged Erasmus too strong to grapple, so took his time, softly singing the hymns of ending as he struck away pieces of the warrior's armour and bled away his might with gentle cuts. There were quicker ways to end one of the lost, but Astaroth would do so only in extremis. The warrior must be confronted and blessed. The final rites of death were as important as the rites of apotheosis and must be correctly observed. Astaroth fought to preserve the secrets of his chapter. He fought to end the rampages of those who could not find a noble end in battle, but most of all, he sought to save their souls. Kindness guided his axe above all things.
"You are a traitor, a betrayer, a worm in the eye of father," shouted Erasmus. "You consort with evil for your own benefit while the Imperium burns. Why?
Erasmus directed a flurry of blows at Astaroth. The High Chaplain stepped back, mindful that even a broken blade propelled with such strength could break his armour.
"I am not Horus, brother," he said softly. "I am your redemption."
He stepped back and around, swinging his axe with the motion, and took Erasmus's leg off at the knee. The Space Marine fell face forward and howled piteously with sorrow. He tried to rise.
I die slain at the hands of my brother."
Astaroth stepped in, kicked the knife from the Space Marine's hand, and with another blow, shattered his armor's power plant, expertly deactivating the battle plate without triggering an explosion. A good part of Erasmus's strength was thus denied him.
"Why?" sobbed Erasmus. "Why does it have to end this way?"
Astaroth squatted down, rolled Erasmus over and onto his back, and pulled free his helm. The warrior's face was swollen with vitae, his eyes blooming with burst blood vessels. His teeth were at their fullest length. But there was yet nobility in him. There always was in the lost. Astaroth rested his palm on the warrior's brow.
"Peace, brother. Be at peace. I am not Horus. I am not the Emperor. I am High Chaplain. And you are Brother Sergeant Erasmus. The wars you speak of were over 10,000 years ago. Now your fight is over too.
Erasmus's eyes cleared a little.
What has happened to me?
The Black Rage. My father's death. Echoing down time.
He gave the Space Marine a solemn stare.
Now listen to me. We are Space Marines. We do not pray. We hold no person to be God, and all gods to be monsters. We give praise to no one but mortal heroes, and we thank the Emperor as a man, and not a divine being. But we will pray, now, you and I, for peace in death.
Astaroth spoke sacred words. Through the fog of rage, Erasmus repeated them, and a little more lucidity returned.
Ah, Lord's anguish, Erasmus said.
Tears spilled from his cheeks.
I feel what the angel felt. I can't stand it. He is sorrowing for me, for all of us. End it swiftly, please.
Fear not, my brother. Mercy is my purpose.
Astaroth rose. The executioner's axe descended. The music stopped, and a new weight was added to the high chaplain's burden. He recovered Erasmus's head and voxed Artemus. Artemus performed his grisly work back in the village. The Primaris Marines guarded the habitat door. The people kept away. They knew something sacred was happening within. Reductor blades soared through bone, and ribs cracked wetly to give up precious gene seed.
Fear not, brothers, Astaroth said to them. Your brother died as all blood angels should, in communion with the great angel Sanguinius.
High Chaplain, said Phidolus, may I have your permission to ask your guidance?
You may.
Will this happen to us? Astaroth answered thoughtfully.
Your creator, Belisarius Call, has many qualities, but he is a braggart and wears hubris like a gown. It is impossible to eliminate Sanguinius's suffering from our souls, but it may be that you are immune from its effects.
Then if we never see what the angel saw, can we truly call ourselves blood angels? Asked Edmund.
You are Primaris Marines, but you are blood angels first. The blood of Sanguinius flows in your veins as it does mine. You may never suffer the way that Erasmus did, but rest assured, you are my brothers, said Astaroth.
He made sure to meet the eyes of each of them, and as he did, he heard a few distant notes of pain. A foretaste, perhaps, of what might come to pass. Artemus joined them.
It is done. Erasmus's gene seed is secure. We will return his armor to the chapter.
Then we are finished here, said Astaroth.
He looked to the sky and opened his voxlink.
Sergeant Dolliman, we are returning. Prepare the Storm Raven for flight. Please inform Eminent Sanguis. We depart immediately. More duty awaits us.
Somewhere, in the immensity of space, a new tune had begun to play. Thanks very much, everybody. Another Guy Haley story. The man's a machine. It's impossible to keep up with him. But this was a good one, and it was the first time we got any sort of hints. A few other things have come out since, but this was the first time we got a hint of Primaris and how they're affected by the gene flaws and whether they have truly been purged from the gene seed bloodlines, like Belisarius Call was saying. So this was a good one. I remember when I did a little review on it when it came out last year, actually. But yeah, Guy Haley again, he's just a god, you know? I think some of the other writers do some stuff that's, like, qualitatively... I don't know, actually. No, I don't even know. I think he probably is the best writer at the minute. And just, I mean, the quantity of stuff he does and the way he's actually able to make characters understandable and relatable. Like Belisarius Kor. I actually like the guy now. Even Gilliman, he does a good job on him, making him likable. You know, realistic, sort of adding emotions to them, which I think a lot of the writers miss out on. He's really good at making characters. And he's, I'd say Josh Reynolds is the funniest writer. But Guy Haley's just as capable of slipping jokes in there. And they're smart jokes as well. Very clever. You know, the guy knows history. You can tell. Anyway, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just ranting. Thanks, everybody, for watching. Please do give a like. Remember to subscribe if you're not subscribed. Let me know in the comments what you think. Let me know in the comments what you think. And, I'll be back again with more very, very soon. In the meantime, cheers. Bye-bye.